From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Congress rolls back internet privacy protections. Democrats roar.
I have a simple question. What the heck are you thinking? What is in your mind?
Republicans rejoice.
The internet was not broken and did not need the federal government to come in and try to fix it.
Also today, closing the gender wage gap in the financial sector through radical salary transparency.
If you can close that gap, it removes one of the structural barriers that's keeping women from moving up the leadership ladder. And when there's more women in leadership and more diverse teams, there's better financial outcomes.
Plus, running a marathon on a treadmill in prison.
I'm in green cotton polyester jail-issued pants and a plain white cotton t-shirt. And my crappy shoes.
That's all next on Radio Boston, right after this.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I have a simple question. What the heck are you thinking? What is in your mind? Why would you want to give out any of your personal information to a faceless corporation for the sole purpose of them selling it?
That was Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano spitting fire last night as the House of Representatives voted to allow internet service providers such as Comcast or Verizon to use, share, and sell data they collect about you without your permission. The measure already passed the Senate, and President Donald Trump is expected to sign it. Congressman Capuano joins us now. Congressman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so what makes you the most angry about this?
It's just crazy. I mean, there is no reason to do this. I mean, we're not talking about internet companies that are on a financial brink of disaster and need to find something else to sell. These companies are healthy. They do a decent job. I'm not complaining. But there is no reason I can think of that to do this, and I have not met a single person, not one, who thinks it's a good idea.
Well, you know, I mean, I feel like a lot of internet privacy advocates, of course, feel the same way, but the ISPs themselves, Comcast and Verizon, they say that they shouldn't have been, you know, they were being regulated under a different set of rules, and the Googles and the Facebooks of the world out there, they didn't to ask anyone's permission, it was putting Verizon and Comcast at a disadvantage.
Well, first of all, they are right. It was a different standard, and I agree with them. It should be level playing field, but the level playing field should have been created by taking the Facebooks of the world and making them live up to the same standard. We shouldn't lower the standards to the lowest common denominator. We should raise the standards to where we want them to be. Everybody I know wants to keep as much of their privacy as they can. They're willing to share some information with a lot of people, but they'd like to have some control over it.
Right. You know, as you know, many Republicans, in fact, the point that you just made about changing standards is exactly the point they were making, but from the opposite perspective. So we've got some tape here from Louisiana Republican Steve Scalise speaking on the floor of the House last night. And he said that Americans don't need the FCC to come in and regulate ISPs because he said in terms of regulating the internet overall, the Federal Trade Commission already does that and does it well. Here's Steve Scalise.
The FTC's light touch and case-by-case enforcement had fostered an internet economy that's become the envy of the world. But rather than following the FTC's proven framework of privacy protection, the FCC came in and overreached and missed the mark with these rules, injecting more regulation into the internet ecosystem. With all due respect, the internet was not broken and did not need the federal government to come in and try to fix it.
Congressman Capuano, what do you think?
It couldn't be more wrong. I don't know. Maybe Steve, he's a great guy, but maybe he never uses the internet and doesn't understand how it works. If you, for the sake of discussion, if you're on a website and you don't like the information they're collecting, you just don't have to go back to that website. How do you get rid of your provider? I mean, I know it's technically possible. How many people are going to be able to get rid of their provider, especially if both providers or the three providers or however many options you have do the exact same thing? You cannot opt out of this. You cannot find a way to opt out of it, and that's the problem. I don't disagree at all that there's an unlevel playing field, but again, I want my privacy as much as I can. If I want to tell you information about myself, that's fine. But if I don't, then it's really none of your business, and certainly you shouldn't be able to sell it And that is the only reason they want this information, in order to sell it to advertisers so they can target you a little bit better than they already do.
So, Congressman, for frequent listeners to the show, they'll know that I am personally very predisposed to advocating for internet privacy, or I'm a big believer in being able to keep private what you think should stay private. But I'm playing devil's advocate here because, on the other hand, you know, data is the currency of the internet. It's the way information is the greatest thing of value in the digital age. And what many people could say and say legitimately, look, in order to tailor the experience to you, in order to give you targeted ads that actually meet your needs, meet your buying habits, that they need to have access to this data, and so why shouldn't they sell it? Because it makes your experience better online.
I don't mean to be disrespectful. Mind your own business. Don't tell me what I want. If that's the thing that amazes me. If that's what you want to do, I'm certainly happy to have a place you can click on every page and say, sure, use my information. If that's what you want, that's fine. But if you don't, you should have the option to say, nope, don't use this information and don't share it with anybody.
But don't people have that option? I mean, they can opt out, though.
They can just stop using the internet, and that's an unreasonable expectation in today's world. I'm not asking anybody to do that. It's like, you know, your tracking system on your cell phone. It's 1,000 things that are happening in our lives that you lose control over. All I want is just a little bit of control so that you can control the information about yourself like you used to be able to do. I understand that when you're in the digital world, you automatically give up some degree of that. But you don't have to give it all up. There's no reason to do it. They don't need that information.
Hmm. Well, so just to be specific, what Congress has voted on gives internet service providers, again, internet service providers like Comcast or Verizon, the option to gather and sell data such as geolocation information, health information, your social security number, browsing history, app usage, content of messages and emails.
Content of emails. That's kind of critical. The content of your emails that you send through that ISP provider can then be sold to someone else.
Hmm. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that under what Congress rolled back essentially means that I should be able to call up Verizon, I should be able to call up Comcast and say, I want to opt out. Isn't that a simple way? No?
It doesn't exist. There's no way to do that. And the only way you can do it is just stop using Verizon or whoever it's going to be. But then good luck trying to find somebody who doesn't do it.
Hmm.
And in the free market system, if I'm competing with you, if I'm competing with Verizon and they do it and they make a bazillion dollars by selling information without telling you, at some point I get to be a competitive disadvantage. I probably get pressure to do the same thing. And why wouldn't I if I can make $1 billion doing it?
Right.
So everybody's going to do it. You will have no choice.
Now, I know this vote just happened, but President Donald Trump is expected to sign this bill into law. Congressman, do you think there is going to be any move afoot to introduce new legislation to combat the vote that just happened last night?
There will be, but we're not going to win right now. In the meantime, we're trying to pressure the president. Honestly, privacy is something that the Republican Party used to tout while I was growing up, and I would think that the most conservative members of the Republican Party would agree with me. We got 15 votes on the floor of the House yesterday by some of the most conservative Republicans because they understand this. And so therefore, we're starting a petition online. It's a last-ditch effort. I know that. We're trying to get at least 100,000 people around the country to sign up. It's www.petitions.whitehouse.gov.
Hmm.
It's the one relative to SJ Res 34. We're trying to get as many signatures as we can. And I don't know that that'll change the president's mind, but he didn't come out and say specifically he was going to vote for it. What was said is, I don't have the exact language in front of me, was something along the lines of his advisors would recommend that he would sign it.
Right.
So my hope is that he can get all the advice he wants. I want him to get advice directly from the American people.
Congressman, one last question for you since I've got you. I'm going to just shift gears entirely because I'd love to hear what your take is on the latest of what's been happening out of the House Intelligence Committee. Devin Nunes, chair, says he's not going to recuse himself. But we also now had this in the past day or so, this kerfuffle over the House Intelligence Committee canceling or delaying testimony from former acting attorney general Sally Yates. Adam Schiff, the ranking member, is saying, what's the holdup? I mean, what's your take?
Devin Nunes, he may or may not be a great guy. I don't know, and I don't really care. but his actions have completely undermined the credibility of anything they find. Even if they come out and say something that is exactly 100% true, there'll be a lot of Americans now who just won't trust it. So therefore, I think I don't want him to resign or recuse himself. I want the investigation taken out of the hands of the partisan Intelligence Committee that has more Republicans on it than Democrats and put into a nonpartisan or at least equally divided committee or outside group would be even better to do the investigation so that whatever the answer is can be trusted by the American people.
Michael Capuano, he represents Massachusetts 7th. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, let's turn back to this question of internet privacy and internet service providers. Joining us now is Ilaria Licardi. She is a research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
Okay, so first of all, tell us more specifically, what kind of data is already generally being tracked out there? I mean, how much could a person or a company know about me specifically, if based on what I'm already putting out there?
So different companies can know different information about you. So Google knows a lot of information about you based on your Google searches, on the contents of your emails. Facebook knows a lot about you, about your social connection, what you browse. And they also extend their tracking abilities outside their immediate company. So they place trackers in different websites. But it's very different than ISP. ISPs have a complete details. Think of it as a phone bill. So an itemized phone bill. So they know exactly where you have been and for how long. And it's very detailed. So everything that you do in from home, where your ISP, for example, is provided.
Because everything that you do goes through that ISP.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. But here's a question. These rules that Congress just rolled back, the rules had only been passed last year.
Yes.
So before, again, it gets a little confusing, but before last year, these privacy rules, which were just canceled yesterday, didn't exist, right? So were ISPs collecting all this data
beforehand? ISP always collects this data. They weren't selling it, but ISP always collects information about what you do. And I'm assuming that they are storing it somewhere. Of course, yes.
Okay, so they were collecting it, but they weren't selling it before last year?
Hopefully they weren't, yes.
But we're not sure?
We're not sure. So AT&T had some sort of programs about targeted advertisements, but then I think it rolled out once this has been discussed. So I don't think they were selling it, at least not publicly, like it's going to happen now.
Okay, yeah. So the difference is now we know for sure that Congress has said they can sell this information.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so you know how I asked Congressman Capuano that I understand that there should be an opt-out provision, that people should be able to contact their ISP and say, nope, I don't want you to sell my information.
Yes.
Does that work? Should it work?
Well, the problem is that even though there is an opt-out mechanism, it might be very hard to actually do. And also people might not opt out because they might not know. So having an opt-out mechanism might not work might not work as well as we expected.
Did you check today?
Yes, I checked today, and there should be an opt-out mechanism, I believe, but I don't know what kind of mechanism will that be.
Interesting. Yes. Now, you know, to me, the one of the biggest differences between the ISPs and all, other internet companies on the other side of those ISPs is that, yes, I mean, I think people in this day and age know that when they use Google products or when they use Facebook, they are, by definition, just giving all that data to the companies. I mean, it's part of the terms of service, but also we're not being charged to use Google, whereas I am being charged to use Verizon.
And that's a very interesting choice. But there is also a very big difference between Facebook and Google and ISPs. So as you said, you're not getting charged for the ISPs, but then Facebook and Google, while they collect a lot of information about you, they are not selling it outright, which I believe what the ISP are going to do. So Google actually provides services for ads. So it targeted their customer, but the customer's profile never leaves Google servers and is completely safeguarded by them. So Google and Facebook, they monetize the people's profiles.
Through the advertising.
Through the advertising, but they do not sell them. So that's different.
Key difference. Okay. Yeah. So what can people do if they want to, short of opting out, which we don't know yet if that's going to be easily done? What can people do to limit how much of their data is tracked and sold by ISPs?
So people, if they wanted to opt out, well, not opt out, if they wanted to safeguard their privacy, they should use service like VPN or Tor. And in that case...
And VPN then, meaning?
A virtual private network.
Those aren't, I mean, are those easy to set up?
So they're not easy to set up, but the EFF has just released a very interesting document where it explains the different services that can be used.
This is the Electronic Freedom Foundation?
Yes. Okay. And hopefully other advocacy group, they will try to set up simple ways to actually set up VPNs and Tors, yes.
And Tors
Tor,
being...
yes. Tor is the anonymous network that can be used either as an operating system or as an addition to browsers. It's very easy to use.
It
as
is?
Well, yes.
Okay, I mean, I don't mean to make light of this because for a second I was just thinking it sounds like we're all going to have to sort of become small-time hackers in order to protect our information.
So VPN, it's not easy to set up. And personally, being a computer science, I haven't used outside services. I either use my university VPN here at MIT, or I set up my own VPN. And it's not difficult for a technical person, but it might be difficult for a non-technical person. But there will be services out there that I think will come in light of this bill. EFF has been one of them, and I think there will be other services that they will be there to provide this kind of safeguards to people they want to.
We were looking this morning, and there's an app for that, yes, as always, and I'm sure there's soon going to be even
many,
more.
Yes.
Well, Ilaria Licardi is a research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So let's talk about the gender pay gap. Women, on average nationally, make about 79 cents for every dollar a man makes. That's probably a familiar number to you. But in the financial sector, the gap yawns even wider than that, 61 cents on the dollar. And there's a movement afoot to change that. The solution advocates are pushing for? Radical salary transparency in some of the nation's largest banks. And the woman at the center of that push is Natasha Lamb. She joins us in the studio now. She's a managing partner at Arjuna Capital, which focuses on sustainable and social impact investing. Natasha Lamb, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Meghna. It's nice to be here.
Okay, so radical salary transparency is my phrase, but what exactly are you pushing for to close the gender pay gap in the financial sector?
I think that's a pretty good phrase. Although, you know, we'd like it not to be radical. We would like it to be an industry standard. And we have filed shareholder proposals now with six banks, including, you know, Bank of America and Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citigroup, asking them to close the gender pay gap, but also report what it is. And we're asking them to do that because, you know, like the technology sector, which we engaged with last year on this issue and which was very proactive. Actually, seven of the nine companies that we engaged with came forward, published their gender pay gap, and committed to close it. And, you know, we're seeing a very sort of night and day difference with the financial sector.
I was just going to ask how Citi and Wells Fargo and BOA and JP Morgan responded.
Well, you know, they're opposing the proposal. So although it will go to a vote at all of those companies' annual meetings this spring, the board has come out and said we oppose that kind of transparency. And, you know, really, as investors, we see this as a data point where companies need to be accountable.
Let me just jump in here.
Yeah.
Have the boards said specifically why they oppose salary transparency? First of all, I'm going back. I'm so sorry. Are you asking for transparency at all levels or at the executive level, the C-suite level? What level are you asking for?
And I think this is why it's not so radical and why these companies should be putting forward their number. We're asking for a general company-wide number.
Okay.
And we're asking for, you know, basically equal pay for equal work, same levels, same job. What's your number? And in the tech field, we saw that that they were pretty small. And, you know, in part, you know, some companies, after we negotiated with them, they came out the next day and said, this is our gender pay gap. Other companies needed to take time, do the analysis, and then reported. And you have to expect that by the time, you know, between the time they agreed to report and when they reported, there were some adjustments made.
Okay. And so more specifically then, what are the boards saying about why they don't want this?
I mean, well, they're paying a lot of lip service to it. They're saying, you know, that they think it's important, that they're looking at it internally, but they're not willing to be transparent and say what it is. So it's really a continuation of a, you know, trust us approach. And that trust us approach has kept the gender pay equity conversation in a black box for decades. And at the current rate of change, women won't be paid a fair wage for another 42 years. So we'd like to see that change.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, boards tend to frown on shareholder activism in general, right? So then you're asking for something which I can imagine they just think would open up a whole can of worms. But I mean, for good reason. I want to go back to what you were saying about how this worked for you in the tech sector, right? Because I'm seeing that, for example, eBay shareholders were asked to vote twice on a similar resolution.
And that's right.
And the first year, only 8% of shareholders voted in support, but there was a big change the next time around. What happened there?
That's right. So in 2015, we went to eBay with a first-of-its-kind proposal. The board opposed it. It only got an 8% vote. The next year, last year, we filed the proposal with 9 tech firms, including eBay. And a lot of them were much more proactive and, you know, said, okay, yes, we're willing to do this. And Intel just published for the second year now that they have 100% gender pay equity. But as peer firm after peer firm started to commit to this, and you saw Apple and Amazon and Expedia and Microsoft, you know, move in the direction toward transparency, the investors started to see this as a competitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they said, if you're not putting out this data, then you're actually at a competitive disadvantage attracting and retaining top female talent. And that's really what we're trying to get to, is how we can close the gender gap in general.
Yeah.
And the gender pay gap is a structural barrier that's preventing that. But, you know, when it went to a vote last year at eBay, it got a 51% vote of investors. So, you know, that was pretty remarkable.
So let me ask you, for example, with Intel and the 100% pay equity, and you mentioned Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, et cetera. I understand, though, that those numbers didn't necessarily include total compensation? Is that right?
Actually, for the most part, they did.
Okay.
When Apple first came out, for instance, at their annual meeting, instead of our proposal going to a vote, Tim Cook came out and said, this is our base salary gender pay gap. And he didn't include bonus and equity. And we really pressed and said, you know, this is the total compensation package. You need to be taking all of it into account. And later in the year, they did publish that data. And we saw that with most of the companies.
They did. Okay, because, you know, going back to the finance sector, I was thinking that those other aspects, bonuses, equity, et cetera, may matter even more. So are you asking for total compensation as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, both in tech and in the financial sector, you know, bonus and stock can play a really large role in the compensation package. So we certainly don't want to leave that out.
Yeah. So, Natasha, if I may ask you, I'd love to hear about your personal experience. I mean, this is your world. You're a managing partner now at Arjuna Capital. So have you personally experienced a pay inequity in terms of your career so far?
Absolutely. I've worked in finance all of my career, and you know, I've not only experienced pay inequity, you know, for the most part, I just experienced gender disparity, and I think a lot of what most women experience in a male dominated field. But you know, I found myself many times sitting around a conference table with all white men in suits and me. And I was sort of the, you know, this interesting outlier. But that's, you know, that's the banking world. And, you know, when you have female financial advisors making 61 cents on the dollar versus what men make, that's an enormous gap. And if you're
it's a 40% gap, right?
It's a 40% gap. Yeah. And women are actually 20 to 30% more likely to leave the financial services sector than any other sector of our economy. So there's, you know, there's the gender pay gap, there's cultural issues at play. And if you're going to solve the issue of not having enough women in positions of leadership, and the reason you want that is that that actually leads to more diversity of thought and better financial outcomes. And that's on a host of metrics, from return on equity to profit margin to stock price performance. So you need to be adjust all of the things that are sort of, you know, preventing women from moving up that ladder.
So in jobs and years past, I mean, how was there a moment, a specific moment, for example, that you could tell us where you found out that, you know, you were doing like work with a colleague and the difference in compensation was enormous?
Yeah, I mean, I never had the transparent conversations with colleagues. Yeah. And that's actually something where, you know, Massachusetts just passed one of the strongest equal pay laws in the country. And that was an update. We were actually the first state to have an equal pay law after World War II. And, you know, that kind of conversation before, companies could come after you for that. That's now changed. And there's more transparency. Employees can go and they can actually ask their employers what their peers are being paid, and they can advocate for themselves. So I recommend, you know, everyone listening to do that. But what I do know is that I was being paid below industry averages, and, you know, that certainly was not equitable.
Right. Now, some of these votes, these shareholder votes, could be taking place fairly soon, spring or early summer, right?
Yeah, so the first votes will be at the end of April, with the remainder, you know, May through June.
And are you feeling, are you feeling optimistic about it?
I feel very optimistic. I mean, the amount of investor support that we saw for these proposals last year was really incredible. And, you know, frankly, you brought up shareholder proposals before. You know, these proposals usually don't garner a majority vote. That's very rare. But even if they're getting, even if you're getting a 20% vote, that is such a strong signal to management that something needs to change.
Well, Natasha Lamb is managing partner at Arjuna Capital, which focuses on sustainable and social impact investing. But she's been talking to us today about her push for more transparency regarding the gender wage gap in the financial sector. Natasha Lamb, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
The new quarterly journal, American Affairs, has not been introduced lightly. It's got some heavyweight introductions here. It's been called a new Trumpist magazine by The New Yorker, the intellectual journal of our Republican moment by The Week, and part of the intellectual future of conservatism by The New York Times. Unveiled last month at Harvard, the journal has received both praise and criticism for its attempt, according to the editor, to fill the void left by conservatives who spent more time opposing Donald Trump than examining the issues that secured him the presidency. The editor of the American Affairs Journal is Julius Krein. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So I read all those weighty descriptions of your journal. Do you agree with them or disagree with them?
Well, I mostly agree. I think to call it a Trumpist magazine, any single word descriptor like that is always going to obscure some things. And I think it was certainly provoked by Trump, provoked by the issues of the last of the campaigns of the last 2 years. And it does look to unite some hopefully interesting people from both the right and the left into creating a new sort of communitarian policy consensus, as opposed to the existing kind of neoliberal policy consensus before Donald Trump. So it sees Trump as an opportunity. But to call it Trumpist, I think, implies a level of relationship with the administration that does not exist.
Okay. Communitarian policy consensus. What do you mean by that?
Mainly, I mean, to put it into one sentence, regrounding political and economic power within the larger society.
So is this an attempt to put an intellectual framework around the movement, the moment, the energy that was captured or encapsulated by the Trump campaign?
I think that would be a good description of the goal.
Okay. This is an interesting challenge here because, you know, even during the campaign, there were some intellectual, some bloggers, for example, who at that time were blogging anonymously because they were...
Yeah, that was me.
That was you?
Yeah.
That was you?
Yeah, that was us. So that's what started this whole thing.
Okay. So I'm curious. I mean, the challenge there at that time was to put a framework around something driven by a man, Donald Trump, who doesn't necessarily have his own personal political philosophy. I mean, what I'm trying to say is I feel like another way to define Donald Trump himself and his movement is his impulsiveness, his tendency to act towards self-interest. He contradicts his own statements. He's kind of inconsistent at times, and he frequently departs from fact. So how are you going to put an intellectual framework around a movement led by a man who's so difficult to pin down?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I would agree, of course, that Trump does not express himself in some kind of systematic, theoretical way. And it may be the case, I don't really know, but it may be the case that he has no theoretical orientation at all. But there was always a very clear direction in his rhetoric, you know, trade policy, immigration, a critique of interventionist foreign policy. Those things are pretty consistent throughout. In fact, you'd have to say on certain key points, he was much more consistent than most of the political rhetoric we're used to for several generations, in which we always expect our candidates to flip-flop and move toward the center and things like that. But to get to the larger point, you're right, of course, that I have, you know, no idea what exactly the Trump administration will do. And there's always a difference in theory and practice. And usually the way these things work is the theoretical doctrine is kind of outlined before a candidate wins on it, where in this case it's the reverse, which prevents a unique challenge. But regardless, the issues that he won on are not going away, and they do need to be better developed and articulated by someone. And we're going to attempt to do that. And to the extent that we can influence the White House as well, that's great.
No, I think it's a laudable goal, but I'm wondering how you may react to criticism that comes from Donald Trump's most fervent supporters themselves, because you're attempting to engage with Trumpism in a manner which I think, you know, I can describe roughly as from elite circles, when so much of what drove his campaign was a fierce anti-elitism.
That's true, but it was against a certain kind of elitism. And unless you think that there will never be any kind of elite in a society, which at least we don't, then you're always going to have an elite. And the question is, what does it represent? What does it espouse? Who does it serve, if anybody? And right now, I think the critique is of a very detached elite that really exists to benefit its own class interests. And the question is, can we reground that again, not only that elite, but the political and economic power that it wields within a larger society to the benefit of more people?
Now, is this necessarily something that was driven by Trumpism? Because, I mean, Bernie Sanders appealed on many of similar issues to millions of people.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's something that Trump captured. I think the conditions were there, you know, much deeper and broader than the Trump campaign itself, though Trump benefited from them. And I think there is a lot of overlap, at least on certain issues, with the Sanders campaign. And like I said, we will be publishing, although this effort really originated from the right, we will be involving and publishing a number of interesting thinkers from the left who are interested in taking their own approach to these issues, which will overlap with ours perhaps more than the traditional ideological divides might indicate. I think perhaps that's what's the most interesting and exciting opportunity presented here, is that we can really have a broader realignment beyond the sort of 1990s post-Cold War consensus into something around deeper lines. And the old categories of right and left simply will not mean as much anymore.
Mm. Well, Jeet here at the New Republic, of course, firmly rooted on the left, he is. You know this criticism. He's said that it's hard to escape the conclusion that the purpose of the magazine is not to develop ideas, but rather to fashion a disguise so that the vulgarity and profanity of Trumpism may be acceptable to prissy elitists. You have responded to this, but I'm just wondering if you could share what your reaction is with us.
I think if you actually read the magazine, you'll see that's not the case. I mean, Trump is not mentioned. It's mentioned hardly at all in the first issue. We're not taking any cues from the administration. And, you know, some people have to oppose these things just out of kind of reflexive political interests. And I'd say that was that. So the best thing I'd say is just read the journal. The first issue is up online and come to your own conclusions.
And how frequently will the journal be out?
It's going to be print edition will be out quarterly. And we will be adding some more online content in between issues in the future.
Well, Julius Krein is the editor of the American Affairs Journal. It was wonderful to have you. Hope to have you back sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Boston Marathon is just a couple of weeks away, and Keith Giroux is preparing to run the marathon for the first time. Or more precisely, he'll be running Boston in the fresh air and under an open sky for the first time. Because on Marathon Day last year, Giroux ran 26.2 miles on a treadmill at the Franklin County Jail in Greenfield, where he was an inmate. WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer has more on a man trying to turn his life around through running.
Keith Giroux is about to take me on a training run in Turner's Falls. And we're talking about hill workouts and shoes and fast marathoners and mile times.
I got down to 523 or 525.
For a single mile.
Yeah.
Okay, I was like, wow. Like world-class. Yeah. Like, wait a second.
No, 525 miles.
So you'll be running beside the Kenyans.
Yeah. Not in this life. I will never be that fast. I will be faster than I am now, but not that fast.
Giroux says his training for the Boston Marathon is going well, even though he logs most of his miles on cold, dark nights on roads around western Massachusetts. During the day, he works 12-hour shifts at a Turner's Falls factory packing boxes. The tough training conditions don't bother Giroux, not given where he's come from.
The contrast between how I live today and how I lived 10 years ago is just so drastic. I started, drinking and smoking cigarettes, before I was 11. I didn't start getting incarcerated until I was 18. And since then, I've accumulated 8 years of incarceration. Every bit of trouble I've ever got into was due to alcohol. Everything I've ever been incarcerated for was addiction-related.
Giroux is 30 now, and his crimes range from breaking and entering to larceny to assault and battery. Back in August 2015, Giroux was still smoking, locked up at the West Tennessee State Penitentiary, and bored. To fight off boredom, he started running laps around the prison yard's perimeter. He followed a grass path beside an electrified razor wire fence. One lap was about half a mile.
What did you think about when you were running around the prison yard?
Probably everything I wanted to do when I got out. Just all the dreams I've had, through all the years I've spent incarcerated. All I wanted to do with my life that I hadn't been able to yet. Really just building a life.
6 weeks after he began running, Giroux was transferred to the Franklin County Jail in Greenfield. He grew up nearby, but there was no yard in Greenfield, just a treadmill. So, after days filled with classes and kitchen duty, he'd hit the treadmill. He'd try to go faster and farther each day. Soon, he decided to run the Boston Marathon in prison. That came with challenges other marathoners never have to worry about.
The shoes I had been running in were absolutely horrible. Plain white Velcro strap orthopedic shoes. that were probably a bit small for me, too. I knew I couldn't run that far in those, so I was running around frantically looking for shoes, but we're very limited in there because you can only have shoes that are approved through their medical department and don't have shoelaces. They're not built for running, you know. So at the last second before we locked in for the night, a fellow inmate lent me his shoes, you know, which were just some old classic Reeboks. They were crap. They were beat up, no support, and on nothing. Not made for running either.
So, at 7:30 a.m. on Monday, April 18th of last year, Giroux started his prison treadmill version of the Boston Marathon.
I'm in green cotton polyester jail-issued pants and a plain white cotton t-shirt and my crappy shoes. I have a portable Walkman radio. It's just a cheap little FM AM radio. I have a towel to wipe the sweat off and all that good stuff. I have a small cup of salt, handful of Jolly Ranchers.
Giroux felt pretty good until he got to 22 miles. At that point, he says he was tuckered out. He slowed to a fast walk for a couple minutes, then sped up as much as he could. He wanted to run across the finish line.
You know, as the last mile approached, everybody started gathering around, and I had quite the little crowd, inmates and staff. And that last half mile, I, you know, felt a little burst of energy coming out. It's like last quarter mile, I cranked it up to 10 and sprinted to the end.
Giroux finished in 4 hours, 14 minutes. He'd hoped to run faster, but his disappointment faded as he set a new goal. He wanted to run a real marathon when he got out of jail.
Every other time I walked out of incarceration, I walked out to not having any idea of what I was going to do with my life. You know, I still had dreams then, but I had no idea of how to set one foot in front of the other to work toward any of those. But this time, you know, I come out with this big goal of running a marathon, and all I have to do is run toward it.
Giroux was released last fall. He ran his first real marathon 3 weeks later. Through Runners on Facebook, Giroux has found a new support group. Other marathoners offer him training advice and encouragement. Giroux's running connections also helped him secure a charity entry into next month's Boston Marathon.
And they always tell you how proud they are of like all you're accomplishing and everything. And it's a lot of motivation to keep doing good things. I've never accomplished anything before. So I've been out of jail now for about 4 months. Just the fact that I haven't found something to get myself back in is an accomplishment in itself. I've also been clean for 4 months that I've been out, which is another huge accomplishment. Every day is a struggle, but it's what allows me to live a life.
And as Giroux keeps running toward the Boston Marathon, he puts more distance between himself and his troubled past.
That story from WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Well, as we've mentioned, the marathon is still a few weeks away. And we wish Keith Giroux all the luck in the world. But let's turn to some major sporting news a little closer in time. The Women's Hockey World Championship is on Friday, and the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team has already scored a major victory. They'd been threatening to boycott the championship because of a significant gap in salaries and funding that players get in comparison to the men. Here's Megan Duggan. She's the captain of the U.S. women's team when the boycott was first announced.
We're at the point where we need to kind of make a move and stand up for what we believe in and what we think is right and fair in order to make progress for not only women in hockey and women in all other sports, but just women in this country and what's, you know, what type of support is fair when it comes to their employers.
Well, this week, the women won their contract dispute, and they won big. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us now with more. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Meghna.
So what did the U.S. women's hockey team manage to win here?
Well, first of all, let me mention that the people fortunate enough to be at the Only a Game 20th anniversary celebration a couple of years ago may remember Megan
That's
Duggan.
Right.
She was an honored guest
That's right.
on that occasion, and we were prouder than ever of her. What they won can, I mean, our listeners can look it up. They won some money, they won some rights, they won some equal treatment, which is all very important. And
okay, just let me jump in here, because for those listeners who won't
they were
be bought-
paid $1,000 a month for 6 months before the competition, the international championships, the world championships. Now they're getting what's much closer to a living wage.
$70,000 per
year. $70,000 a year.
Yeah.
And not only that, much more important probably is that they're getting the same sort of respect that the men got. They will be accommodated and they will fly as the men have flown, and they will be treated in a manner that indicates that they don't have to be second-class citizens any longer.
Just to put a little more grist in the mill here, before they put their feet down, or their skates down, I should say.
Or actually pick their skates up and say, no, we're not going to skate.
Yeah, I mean, another way to describe how profound the difference was in funding and respect. I mean, I take your point, Bill. USA Hockey used to spend about $1 million annually supporting the women's team. They spend $3.5 million on the men's development team, mm-hmm. which is the under 20s. I mean, right. that's another sort of measure of how giant the disparity was.
Yeah, the disparity was ridiculous in every respect. But probably more important in the long run is the fact that by saying they would not play until they were treated equally, they collected together an enormous group of people. Major League Baseball Players Association, NHL Players Association, NFL Players Association. These are men's unions that supported them. The USA Hockey tried to recruit replacement players. They went to the Pro Women's Hockey League. The head of the Women's Hockey Players Association said, how are we going to advance our game if we're scabs? We're not playing. They went to the colleges. The girls said, we're not playing. They went to the high schools and the beer leagues, and the female hockey players said, no, we're not playing. In other words, the solidarity is really the important thing here. And in the age of Donald Trump, and in where we're still trying to deal with what Ronald Reagan did to unions in this country, this was a magnificent victory, not only for women, but for people who value solidarity and camaraderie in a struggle against unfair circumstances. So I couldn't be happier. And I hope they'll win the thing again. They're the defending champions, and I hope they win the world championship again. But this victory is a bigger deal than whatever they'll do on
the
ice.
I have to say, I mean, good for USA Hockey for finally coming around. But in hearing you say that they reached down into the high school leagues to try to find replacements for gold medalists.
Absolutely.
I mean, the USA women are world champions.
It would have been a disgrace.
I mean, that's pathetic.
It could have been an utter disgrace, and I'm glad that it
didn't come to
that.
No offense to those high school
great
hockey
kids.
Players, but
right.
Like, I mean, come on. And also in that wonderful list of support that you outlined for us, Bill, you didn't mention, and I think I saw this somewhere, that even members of the men's Miracle on Ice team.
Yes, and 20 U.S. senators.
Yeah. Now,
why there weren't 100 U.S. senators, I can't tell you, but at least there were 20, and it's a step in the right direction, so I'm for it.
All right, well, let's move on now to USA Soccer and the men's national team. Here's some sound.
Chuck Dempsey, go! 56, and it's thanks to the kid. Just like that, the U.S. takes the lead.
All right. Well, that's Clint Dempsey scoring the only goal of Team USA's Team USA against Panama. The game ended in a 1-1 tie, and Team USA is struggling in the qualifiers for the 2018 World Cup.
Well, they're not struggling quite as badly as they were two games ago. They got one point against Panama, and they got 3 points against Honduras by beating them. So that was good. Before that, you could really characterize them as struggling, I think. They're not in a bad position. If they win their games at home and play reasonably well, they should be fine for qualifying for the Olympics. And it would certainly be, World Cup, excuse me, but it would certainly be a terrible disappointment if they didn't at this point in the development of soccer in this country.
They should be fine. A ringing endorsement from Bill Littlefield. Okay. Well, the next qualifying game is in June against Trinidad.
That's
and
why I say it should be fine. I refuse to get upset about anything that's not going to happen until June. Too many other things to worry about between now and then.
You always remind me to maintain perspective. Okay, well, one of those things to worry about, how about March Madness? It's now moving into April. We've gone from 68 teams to the final four. Mm-hmm. Remaining teams in the women's and men's tournaments play this weekend for a spot in the finals. Sunday for the women and then Monday for the men in the final. So what do you say? Who do you expect to see in the final, in the men's final four?
Well, I hate to make predictions.
I always ask you every week,
but I will make one. I will make one. It's Gonzaga against North Carolina in the men's final. That's my prediction. And it's based on nothing except the fact that just before I came in here, I looked and scratched my head and said, why not? So I don't really have any idea. At this point in the tournament, and really actually all throughout the tournament, what happens is somebody gets incredibly hot for some team, and sometimes it's somebody that the experts have expected to get very hot, and sometimes it's somebody who comes out of nowhere, and so it's very hard to make predictions, except I will predict that UConn will win the women's side because they beat teams by roughly 40 points every night, and it's very hard to see how they are going to be slowed down by anybody this time around.
That's not even a daring prediction. I'm going to put it out there, and I'm going to say it'll be UConn and Mississippi State in the final for the women. I'm pulling for Mississippi because
UConn's playing Mississippi State in the semi. So,
UConn-Stanford
or UConn-South Carolina. I love UConn-Stanford because the matchup has so many subplots that we don't have time to get into, but I think UConn is going to come. I know UConn's going to come out on top of this one.
That's it for today. That's Bill Littlefield from Only a Game. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.